been a week of good news for the administration. We've had a great week. We've got the government actually funded through September. We got a health care bill done. We've actually got a great jobs report today, as you said. We've had a really good week.
Very good report. I mean, I don't think there's anything you can look at that doesn't say this is a real positive versus the last numbers.
I'm cautious to say it definitely is a good report. It's not a great report.
We are facing a long-term productivity challenge. Even if you were to jump the number up a little bit or reduce it a little bit, it still signals that we're having a problem in our economy.
Yes, a soft spot and a surprising soft spot. I mean, I think if you asked any economist a year and a half ago what wages would be doing if the unemployment rate was around 4.5% for some months, we would have said more acceleration than we're actually seeing, and we're not getting it.
I think the American economy is a horse that has been weighted down. It's a thoroughbred that wants to run. Once we take off with the Washington weight, that horse is going to absolutely take off.
All right, take off.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, riots and protesters being killed in Venezuela, oil and commodities tumbling, Puerto Rico declares bankruptcy while Bitcoin soars to over $1,600 to overtake the price of gold. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. In Hour 1, Art Hill will be joining us. He thinks stocks are going through consolidation, but he does see an eight-month cycle that ends in the month of May, with the high possibility of a correction coming in June. Art will be joining me in Hour 1. He's very favorable on technology, but he does believe what's happening will be merely nothing more than a correction. Also coming up later on in the program, bullion dealer Kathy Derby joins us, saying, you know what, people are missing what's really going on in the gold market. The real story is in the wholesale market, which is central banks and large institutions, and they've been gradually stepping their bid higher for gold in the 1240 to the 1260 range. Meanwhile, we're seeing the exhaustion effects with investors as widespread disgorging and dumping takes place by individual investors as wholesale market starts bidding up a higher price for gold. That's coming up along with Ryan Poplava in the first hour on what moved the markets. It was another positive week for stocks overall. All of that in Hour 1.
And I'm John Loeffler. You know, most major market tops end when stocks are selling at high and extreme prices. And every one of these pop-offs, so to speak, usually is preceded by Fed rate hikes. This is the second highest priced stock market in history. So if this is a bubble, if we're approaching a top and it will burst, where is the bubble hiding right now? We're not seeing it in major things like we did in the 1990s in tech and internet stocks, or like we did in the 2000s with the real estate and the mortgage issue. So where would that bubble be hiding itself right now? And if it's there, why is no one warning anyone about the overpriced stocks? That'll be the first part of the big picture today. And you know what? Oil, the coming age of volatility. The rules of the international oil market seem to be shifting right now. And most of the market observers are focused on the area of inventories rather than understanding that between shale and OPEC now, we have a whole new world opening up. And the real question is, will it be an age of volatility? And if so, will it wind up becoming a free-for-all rather than some of the stability that we have enjoyed over the last few decades? All of that coming up today on The Big Picture right here on the Financial Sense News Hour. And first, as we always do, we take a look at what happened in the markets this week. Ryan Poplava, CEO of PFS Group, is rejoining us. So welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour. Here it is for the wrap-up. Time to look at the news this week to see what are the drivers and catalysts moving financial securities both here and abroad, but of course mainly here. Not so much there. The earnings season is starting to simmer down now, with Apple being a big announcement this week. It's also the first week of the month, and what that means is a fair amount of economic data hit the tape, like the manufacturing, the non-manufacturing surveys, and of course the jobs data. And regardless of how much distaste we have for economic modeling, these announcements are still actionable information that indeed moves the market in one shape or form or another. So here we are. Tell us this week, Ryan, what's happening down on Wall Street?
Well, John, it's been a very busy week, not just on Wall Street, but also in Washington, D.C., as many of our listeners know. It was a mix of both monetary policy, kind of shifting things in the market, as well as fiscal policy, and also some technical setups as well that are out there influencing investors and the market tape. So let's talk about what factually happened this week, and then maybe we can talk about some of those rumors, things that are going on, the articles, the Wall Street Journal, Reuters, everyone talks about what may happen in the future, et cetera, et cetera. Sometimes those things can really move the market, but you know, most of it right now is tying into the fiscal side of things. You know, we can also jump into some economic news as well, if you'd like to talk about that. Despite this really being a busy week in market news, not a whole lot happened that has really changed the market outlook since last week. However, there are two interesting things to me. One, John, there was a slight correction in treasuries, and we started to see yields go back above, I think it was 2.35% on the 10-year treasury. And then also we saw the dollar, I don't know if it's new lows this year, I'd have to go back and look at the chart, but I know fresh lows right now going on in the dollar. And then finally, secondly, the correction is going on in commodities now for 3 weeks for many of the different commodities. Oil, we've been looking at prices of iron as well as precious metals, and there's been quite a significant correction going on in commodities in the immediate term. Most of the correction in treasuries, as I'm talking about this week in the dollar, came from the Federal Open Market Committee meeting Wednesday, in which the policy statement said the committee believes the slowing in growth during the fourth quarter was likely to be transitory. You know, it's actually been a while since we've heard that word. Inflation risks are roughly balanced, what they said, and there was no discussion yet really about the balance sheet, although there's been a lot of stuff off the tape. You know, we've heard comments from many Fed officials who are starting to say that that is something they're looking at officially. Not yet. Because the growth language didn't weaken, as I said, we saw yields go up in treasuries, treasury prices go down. And they went up on Thursday, went up on Friday, also based on the jobs report, which was a positive. So overall, as I said, I was watching really the correction in treasuries. For me personally, I wanted to see that happen because we've been seeing the liftoff in risk-on type assets, reflationary assets. We've got the NASDAQ has been breaking out above 6,000. Where we finished on Friday, the S&P was at 2399. So if we break out above that price, we're looking at all-time highs also on the S&P. And for me, technically, I want to see that all of these indices are following each other, and we want to see that yields are going up, signaling that reflationary trend.
Okay, so backing up here, investors were looking at soft data along with the Trump fiscal policy optimism, which has been lasting ever since really the election, predicting escape velocity for the economy when we hear we get a weak Q1 in the United States. And meanwhile, numbers continue to improve overseas. So you guys have started to increase your foreign exposure, I would imagine, haven't you? I mean, are you continuing to do so, or are you starting to move funds back into the U.S., given that we've already gone through a weak quarter? And then finally, Ryan, what's going on with commodities?
You're right, John. We're not reversing our stance just to bring maybe funds back into the U.S. because we had a weak quarter with the expectation that next quarter is going to be better. We do think that, and we still have our U.S. allocation, but we're not going to shift out of our foreign exposure just for one weak quarter in the U.S. Mainly, our exposure right now is really reflecting where we see valuations. And if valuations we see are at pretty decent levels in the U.S., not highly over bubble expensive like in 2000, but definitely elevated. And given where we're still curious to see what happens with fiscal policy, there's no real very clear picture yet on where things are going. I think somebody was saying, I think in the U.S. Treasury, expectations for a 3%, was that Mnuchin looking at 3% GDP growth by next year? Bernanke said something like, not for the next 3 years, I think, this week. But we're increasing our exposure overseas because we do see those attractive valuations. We're looking at, you know, the French election, that there's less of a move towards really outright, you know, destroying, you know, Armageddon for the EU. You know, that's not here. So we're still keeping that area and increasing our exposure to it. So yeah, commodities, the big move down this week was in oil. I think specifically on Thursday, almost 5%. A lot of this weakness in oil has been based recently on discussions about OPEC's production cut extension and U.S. supply. So going back and forth between those two, articles being written about it. Also, iron ore this week was just slammed due to concerns over China's record port inventory levels that has been that's being discussed, tightening credit issues over there, possibly hurting demand, as well as real estate, you know, that being an issue financially for their markets and economies. And then domestic production starting to ramp up. There's been a lot of discussion about that too. Tie those two, you know, the weakness in oil and the weakness in iron with ongoing precious metal weakness since that first round of the French election was not really a worst case scenario that we saw some gold weakness. And it's been just, you know, like I said, a really few tough weeks in commodities. Some I've talked with technically think that maybe in oil that it might be overdone, possibly some capitulation. You look at Friday's trading, there was an intraday bottom and a reversal. So there is some evidence that we might have seen some short-term capitulation. But speaking of the French election, John, the final round of voting is this weekend. And Macron, pro-EU, is up in the polls. So if he loses to Le Pen, who wants to, you know, her slogan is choose France, you know, markets are going to get hit huge on Monday if she wins. So watch the news Sunday night to get an idea of how the futures will be opening on Monday morning. I know I will be. Speaking of polls, you know, if we look at, you know, okay, the polls say Macron, so far, so good. You know, look at what happened with Brexit. Look at what happened with Trump. Polls in both situations were favoring for a different outcome than what actually happened. So don't trust the polls completely. We got to be watching to the last minute on Sunday.
Yeah, if you remember to the 1994 overturn in the elections that happened back, well, 1994, obviously, it was the same thing. The polls were almost the opposite of what came out, you know, that were taken when people went out to vote. And so that throws some question on to their sampling patterns. Of course, a lot of times people don't actually reveal how they're going to vote for fear of social pressure.
Yeah.
You know, you vote secretly and quietly, you do what you're going to do. And so they're not about to reveal that. But yeah, no, polls have never been. And even this time when we were running up to the elections, the one thing we kept observing was that the polls were favoring Mrs. Clinton. But we began to look at the numbers of people at Clinton rallies versus Trump rallies and other related data. And early on, we were saying here, there is something wrong with the polling. You know, you can see this disparity already. And of course, that's what showed up afterwards. So there have definitely been some polling upsets in the past year. So anyway, what else happened this week? It is going to be interesting, isn't it? Because everything's in a topsy-turvy upset, and you can't help but feel we're being dragged towards a new destination, geopolitically, at least, not to mention economically. Now, that's just an intuition. That's not something you put a lot of faith into until you get some data to support it. Anyway, what else happened this week besides the correction in commodities and the Fed's FOMC meeting? Anything else that is important to share with listeners?
Well, there's, like I said, beyond just the actual factual news of what's happened this week, there's been a lot of discussion, a lot of articles written about what could be, what can't be, what are the rumors out there. And as everyone knows, the healthcare repeal and replace law did pass in the House narrowly with about 217 votes. That's a one vote margin. And it's already been said that the Republicans in the Senate plan to have their own version. But overall, it's being looked at as a feather in Trump's cap. And I would have to agree. The market wants to see progress with those different areas that Trump is focusing on and what he got elected for. You know, a couple of articles earlier in the week floated the idea that Republicans may abandon the Byrd rules 10-year requirement, possibly enhancing any tax reform being more permanent. That's a real concern here. You know, we talked about what Trump wanted to do last week. And essentially, he's asking for quite a bit, essentially a bit of a shotgun approach, saying, hey, let's look at all these areas. And so that's what's going to go on in May. You know, they're going to look at what can be, where's the compromise, what can we pass, what's going to work for both parties. Then Mnuchin commented about considering an ultra long bond, which helped steepen the curve a little this week, but isn't anything new. You know, it's been discussed before, something longer than a 30-year treasury. And then Trump told Bloomberg earlier in the week, and this is kind of, it kind of tells you where really things are going. Trump said that he'd like to consider a modern Glass-Steagall, essentially, law. And this version would be, you know, what does that mean? What do you mean modern version? It's the idea was breaking up the investment side of the business banks from the loan side of business of banks. And but I don't really know what he means by a modern version of that. But then only an hour later, he was addressing a group of bankers at the White House criticizing the Dodd-Frank Act and bank regulations just in general. So not really clear yet what his message is, what his plan is on the deregulation side, right? He's talked about taxes already. We talked about healthcare reform, and he's talked about infrastructure. In fact, he said this week he hopes to have some much clearer information on that later in the next week or two. So yeah, remember, his plan, infrastructure, tax reform, and deregulation. We've seen two so far, mainly on the tax reform side just last week. Healthcare, obviously working with the Republicans in Congress. Infrastructure, we'll get news on that in the next couple of weeks and maybe start to hear on the deregulation side. You know, that could be a catalyst for the market. The market moves on news. And so if we start to hear something there that props things, that could be another catalyst for the pro-growth story. So beyond that this week, you know, looking at the rest of May to discuss really details about more of this corporate tax rate, among the many of the other items he discussed, the idea was that May would be a big month for really discussion between White House and Congress to form a real solid plan. And then, you know, just fiscal policy in general and politics, you know, like I said, John, they're going to continue to be at the forefront of the market's concern this year and just really a big catalyst. We're going to need to continue to watch the articles written about this administration and also the administrations overseas. We got a lot of elections going on, France, et cetera, looking at what's going on with the EU and how things develop for the UK.
Yeah, and obviously France is going to be the big thing this weekend, but there are other elections this year because Germany's coming up on elections as well. And it looks like Merkel is in much better condition to retain office, but that remains to be seen. You know, this is a pretty volatile situation. Oh, by the way, you forgot one thing. How'd the jobs numbers look?
Right. Yeah, I get a little excited about the fiscal stuff. Jobs were up. You know, the real fear was having another sub 100,000 print, and that didn't happen. It was around 211,000 additions last month, and an unemployment number actually at 4.4%, the lowest since May of 2007. Obviously, the participation rate dropped a little bit, like a tenth of a point, I think. But the only other couple of numbers worth mentioning was the low auto sales figure at 16.88 million units, annual sales below expectations. And then some of the other numbers, I think durable goods were up. So overall, a reflationary week in the markets, pro-growth with that hat tip from the Fed on Q1 and its transitory remark on the year so far. And that really cemented with the jobs print, the move up in the market this week. It wasn't completely stellar, but nonetheless, we're up here near the highs on the S&P again and possibly new all-time highs next week, maybe. Let's see. Depends on the French election.
Yep. And we will be watching it Sunday night here in the North American area. So Ryan Preplava, appreciate it. CEO of PFS Group. We'll see you again next week, where I'm sure we're going to be continuing. This sounds like a serial show, doesn't it? Stay tuned next week for the exciting outcome of the French election.
Elections.
So, elections. Yeah. Here we go.
2017.
Have a good weekend, Ryan.
You too, John. We'll talk to you next week.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
One of the things that we saw last year was very strong demand for silver in the photovoltaic market. And part of the demand that we saw was people buying solar panels in 2016, China and the United States, out of concern that the subsidies in those two countries would go away this year. So some of the demand that you would have seen this year occurred last year.
Well,
it's been somewhat of a difficult week for the markets, not doing much of anything, but there is one market that is standing out. Joining us on the program from StockCharts.com is Art Hill. And Art, let's begin with the major averages. I have charts of Dow Industrials, the S&P 500, and the Russell 2000. And basically, for the last couple months, they look like they're trying to consolidate up and down. They haven't really gone anywhere. But one chart that really stands out is the NASDAQ, which keeps breaking out to higher records. We're at over 6,000. So what are these charts telling you? The divergence in sideways between the major averages and then the breakout of the NASDAQ. What is that saying?
Well, I think it does speak to the leadership that we're currently seeing in the market, and that is from those large cap tech stocks, because even though the NASDAQ is a very broad index of tech stocks, it still is heavily weighted towards these large cap tech stocks, Facebook, Amazon, Alphabet, Apple, and Microsoft. And they have been the clear leaders, and they're helping push the NASDAQ higher and the NASDAQ 100 in particular higher. And so that's why they're getting these outsized gains, and that's why they're leading. And then, you know, when you broaden out and you start including other industry groups, because the NASDAQ is so tech heavy, and you're looking at other industry groups like finance, which has been lagging in 2017, then you have more of a flatter picture emerging when you look at something like the Dow or especially small caps. You know, the Russell 2000 has been going pretty flat since December, and it picked up, though, in the latter part of April. It had that nice move up, and I know the S&P small cap just hit a 52-week high intraday, I think it was. So we're getting some pickup in small caps, and the question is that going to follow through? The Russell did hit a 52-week high there in late April, and it's pulled back over the last 7 days or so. So I'm thinking that this is maybe a pullback after that surge, and I'm watching to see if we can continue higher and get small caps back in the game.
Yeah, because, you know, when you look at these indexes, the Dow, the S&P, the Russell, or even if you look at the Dow Transports, they all pretty much have a similar chart pattern. They've been trading up and down within a narrow range. Art, is that something you usually see when you have a big takeoff in stocks, basically the day after the election? The markets just went ballistic. It looked like a NASA space launch. I mean, just everything went up, including energy for a while, and then we get towards the end of the year. But since the beginning, the last couple months, it looks like it's just trying to consolidate and it's waiting for something, some kind of catalyst to break out. But it seems like most of these markets have just been abiding time. They're not really doing much of anything.
Well, when you look at that rocket that was lifting off in November and you look at the Russell, you know, it was up 20% the 4th of November until like the 9th of December. And it had the biggest surge of all the major indexes from that November-December period. So it had the most to digest in a way. But even though it's digesting, it still has a slight upward trajectory going from January here until April, May. And whereas the Dow had a surge in that November-December period, it moved flat into January and then had another surge from mid-January to the latter part of February, early March, and it's been flat now. It's kind of a stair-stepping pattern because you need to take two steps up, maybe one step back, or you need to trade sideways in order to consolidate these gains and have a little bit of a rest for the next move. So I would still think the bias is still towards the upside because I haven't seen any evidence to suggest that we're going to have a reversal here. And I would be more in the continuation camp than the reversal camp.
Let's move on to interest rates. When the Fed raised interest rates in December, they said they increased their rate increase possibilities for this year. They said instead of 2, we're now going 3. They followed through with that. 3 months later in March, they raised interest rates. Now, the experts thought as a result of that second rate hike, the dollar would strengthen, interest rates would head higher. Instead, just the opposite. The dollar went down and interest rates went down. So as you look at the 10-year bond yield and you look at the dollar, what are the charts telling you?
Well, the dollar, I know over the past 2 weeks, it's been hit where you have the euro surging and the yen falling. And so that surge in the euro has been offset by the weakness in the yen. Now, that's just over the last 2 weeks. But when you look at the 10-year, it's been flat as well. And it's doing what we saw in the Russell 2000, where you had that big liftoff in November and then flat from mid-December until now. So I don't think it's a clear picture yet what's going to happen here with yields. But I think it could hold an important clue for the stock market, because the stock market and the bond market usually rise for different reasons. You know, the stock market's going to rise on the heels of stronger economic expectations and stronger growth, whereas that's going to be negative for the bond market. And so it's a really good proxy looking at those two to measure the risk appetite out there in the financial markets. Bonds are for safe havens. Stocks are for riskier assets. And so what concerns me, though, is that you've seen treasury yields move down from mid-December until now, and stocks are still moving up. Not by much, but there's a bit of a discrepancy going there. So I'm not sure that's going to play out. But I do know that gold has been hit by this move in treasury yields over the last 2 weeks. It took a massive decline, and you can see the treasury yields moved up from about 2.2% to 2.373%. And then the gold SPDR, it fell around 5%. So it really took a hit. It's very sensitive to treasury yields right now in an inverse way.
Yeah, because usually commodities travel in the opposite direction of the dollar. And the dollar has been weak. It has been falling since the beginning of the year. But you take a look at two commodities that usually go in the opposite direction of the dollar. Let's take them. You mentioned one is gold. So there's weakness in gold. We've seen a sell-off. But also, we've seen the same thing happen in the oil market, where this week we saw oil prices tumble down to $46 a barrel.
Yeah, I think oil is working off of something else. And I guess being a technical analyst, you would say that there's just more supply out there than there is demand. And that's exactly what the chart is telling us. You know, the dollar, of course, is a factor, but there's a factor out there that is a bigger influence than the dollar right now. I'm looking at the June crude oil futures. And you can see that, you know, it was holding this 47, 48 level in September, in November, in March, and then it just plunged right through it this past week. And so that's like an 8-month low when it moved down below $46 a barrel. And that's just telling you that supply is overwhelming demand at this stage.
And so when you see a dollar weak like it is right now, but you also see interest rates, I wonder if interest rates are reflecting maybe what we're seeing coming out in the economic numbers. I think everybody was surprised that first quarter GDP fell below 1%. Now, everybody's talking about stronger economic growth. The markets have been going up based on the Trump presidency, tax cuts, infrastructure spending, deregulation, the repeal of Obamacare, which the Republican House did on Thursday. So they've been anticipating greater economic growth. But, you know, Art, we're just not seeing that reflected in the actual economic numbers that are coming out.
Yeah, I think you have a good point there that the bond market is looking ahead towards the economy and the economic growth prospects that are out there. And so it did build in some prospects for economic growth with that surge in November when Treasury yields moved from around 1.7% all the way up to 2.6%. But now they've been edging lower over the last 5 months or so. And so if they keep edging lower, then that would be a negative for the stock market. But if you look at a longer term chart, it looks like this could be some sort of a consolidation, this 5 month working its way lower in the 10-year yield, because we're still well above the levels we saw in October. And I'm watching to see if we can get a reversal here and get that uptrend back going for treasury yields, and that would be a positive for stocks.
Yeah, because the Fed met this week and they basically didn't say much of anything other than that we're still raising interest rates. So, you know, I'm looking at the futures market and it's widely anticipated they go again in June, which would take the Fed funds rate to 1.25%. It doesn't seem to be
or the market doesn't seem to have, or the Fed action seems to have any action or reflection on the bond market, because usually you would think that the dollar would strengthen with the Fed saying that they're going to go again and interest rates would start to rise. The only thing that we're seeing that reflected is in short-term interest rates. Art, as you look at these different sectors within the S&P, I mean, the clear standout has been the technology sector. Do you see anything else that looks strong in your opinion, or anything that looks like it's either breaking down or about ready to break out?
Well, yes, I was liking healthcare. I think healthcare looks really good. And you can even see that when you look at the equal weight healthcare sector, because that's telling you what's happening within the sector. So the equal weight healthcare sector hit a 52-week high with a move that it had this past week. And it's leading the XLV, which is the SPDR, because it's still below its March high. But if you look over the last 2 weeks for performance, you've got leadership coming from healthcare. And it's not just a few healthcare stocks. You've got medical devices hitting a new high. You've got healthcare providers hitting a new high. You had biotechs breaking out as well. So there's a lot of strength throughout the healthcare sector, and this is one I would keep my eye on.
So right now we've got technology, we have healthcare. Anything else standing out, for example, industrial stocks, cyclical stocks? Because the president is talking about, look, we're going to do healthcare. We need that to do tax cuts. And when we do tax cuts, then the next thing is infrastructure spending. So anything that's reflected, for example, in the industrial sector or cyclical stocks that would be, let's say, beneficiaries. I know Barron's did a study on Caterpillar, which is one of the big Dow stocks, which would be a big beneficiary of infrastructure spending. And that stock has been taking off.
Well, when I look at the industrial sector, I'm still bullish on the industrial sector. If you take XLI, which has General Electric as its biggest component, and General Electric is actually down over the last 2 weeks, but XLI is up because the other components are making up for the loss in General Electric. But, you know, XLI, like the rest of the market, had that big surge from November to December. And then since December, it's been working its way higher. You know, it's up around 5-6% from December in more of a sustainable advance, if you will. So I still see constructive price action in the form of a slower uptrend for industrials since December. And if you want to get a little bit more granular, we did have a bit of a breakout with the surge there in late April. There was a bit of a gap when it broke above that early April high. So I think I'm still bullish on industrials.
As we look at the major markets right now, they're still in that consolidation mode going sideways. But as you pointed out, with an upward slant, whether you're looking at the S&P, the Russell, or the Dow Industrials, what would you be doing right now if you had money that you could put to work? Would you be sitting, waiting for these things to break out? Or do you think you would put some of that money to work here?
Well, I am of the opinion that the trend is in force until it is proven otherwise. We don't know how far or how long it will run. Now, I did pen an article marking the what I call the 8-month cycle. And that means, you know, the strongest 8 months of the year are going to end here in May. And then June, July, August, September begins the 4 weakest months. But until we get a trend confirmation, in other words, a signal from the S&P, I would be bullish, and I'm looking at banks because I saw a recent breakout in the XLF. It had a little correction, and then it pulled up, turned up in late April and had a little breakout. So I'm liking XLF, and I'm also liking healthcare and biotechs, and those are some places that I would consider putting money to work. Now, if we get a, say, if the S&P 500 moves below its 125-day EMA, exponential moving average, I use that because it's 6 months. That's kind of a medium-term time frame for me. But say if in June or July it moves below that 125-day EMA during the seasonally weak part of the cycle, then I would put some money off the table and pull back because I think that would be a signal we're getting a correction.
Yeah, usually the old Wall Street adage, sell in May, go away, come back after Labor Day. Now, last year around this time, we had the Brexit vote. The market corrected for 3 days. It was flooded with liquidity, and we had a great summer rally. But traditionally, as you get into the summer months, the market weakens. And let's say after September, October, and you get that last three-month strong finish to the end of the year. Do you expect that to play out this year?
Well, I'm hesitant to get into expectations and forecasting, but that's our job. So I would say with the run-up that we've had, the odds do favor some sort of a summer correction as we move into June and July. So that's the area or the time frame I would look for maybe a correction to take hold. But again, watch the charts first and foremost, because the seasonal patterns need to be put in the back of your mind, because as you said, last year, you know, we had the Brexit fiasco, but then we moved right higher again. So keep those charts first and foremost on your page.
Well, listen, Art, as we close, why don't you tell everybody about your website, stockcharts.com. It's my favorite website for charting, and you just gave it a new facelift.
Yes, we just updated a couple of major pages on our website. The homepage has been revamped, and we've also revamped the members page, and it serves as your dashboard when you come to the website for your market analysis. So you can see your scans there, you can see the market overview, you can see the market movers, and of course you can create charts and you can annotate your charts. And we have a really great market summary page, which I know you like a lot, Jim. And it's just a one-stop place to get a nice overview of the market. And you can see the percentage change for the major indices, for the sectors. You can sort these columns. So I'd recommend you go there to check out throughout the day what's happening in the market. And you can even change that. You can see an end-of-day view or intraday if you want to see what's happening during the day.
And you also have some free stuff on the site, do you not?
We do. We have a page on the site that's called Free Charts. And if you go to that page, you can create point and figure charts. You can create performance charts to compare up to 10 different symbols. We've got relative rotation graphs, RRGs, which are also very good. And speaking of the sell in May and go away, we also have seasonality charts. So on the right-hand side of that free charts page, you're going to see the navigation links. And if you click on that seasonality link, you can create a seasonal chart to see how the seasonal patterns unfolded for any symbol. And it goes up to 20 years.
Once again, the stock site is called StockCharts.com, and we've been speaking with one of its proprietors, Art Hill. Art, thanks for joining us on the program.
Jim, appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
North Korea is already at an advanced nuclear stage. It doesn't mean that there are still not plenty of obstacles as they're trying to refine their weapons program and achieve, most importantly, a long-range weapons delivery system that can reach the United States reliably. And that will take a little bit more time. But the details as such don't matter as much as the reality that North Korea is already a nuclear state. It's a political question of whether the United States wants to recognize it as one, if it's even prepared to. But when you compare the United States sort of kicking the can down the road and it doesn't have any good options of dealing with North Korea, which is why this problem has persisted across multiple administrations, you know, you compare that to the regional players right next door to North Korea that have very much accepted that this is a nuclear state. There's not kind of a false illusion that, you know, this can be reversed in any significant way. I don't think you have high hopes within the region that a dialogue is actually going to reverse North Korea's nuclear ambitions. They're too far along at this point, and a dialogue with this administration is not going to give Pyongyang the level of regime security that they would be looking for to give up their nuclear program.
Well, we've seen the price of gold and silver tumble from reaching a peak. Over the last couple of years, we've seen gold rise, we've seen it fall. Where is gold heading in the future? And more importantly, what are gold markets looking globally? Because it is one of the true international currencies. Joining me on the program is Kathy Derbys. She's a bullion dealer. And Kathy, I wonder if you would just put this gold market into perspective. We've come a long way in 17 years from, let's say, where the price of gold and silver were, going back to the year 2000 to where they are today. So I wonder if you give us just a brief kind of history and background and put this into perspective in terms of where we are today.
Be happy to, Jim. Thanks a bunch. When we look back to where the gold and silver secular bull market began, as you said, in the early 2000s, and of course we had a nice rally, the beginning of the bull market, into the historic highs, which we all know now was 2011, where gold was near 1900 and silver near 49. That was the temporary peak, and then we saw a 4.5 year or so bear market ensue after that, of which, is my opinion, ended in December 2015 when the Fed raised rates for the first time in 10 years. So the bear market lasted about 4.5 years. And since then, we've had just steadily rising in a stair-step fashion, both gold and silver. So let's look at what was going on at the peak, near the peak, and just after the peak in 2011. I remember it distinctly. We had obviously record high prices. We had enormous amounts of buying across the board, coins, bars, gold, silver, platinum. The sentiment was as bullish as I've seen it. As a dealer, we had to really look to source all kinds of coins and bars. We had slowdowns in production and from the mint, the U.S. mint in particular. Silver Eagles were stopped, I believe, twice. Premiums were high across the board. I was getting so many calls from people who wanted to be in the business. They just had to be in the business, help me start to be a dealer. And of course, phones were ringing off the hook. So that was 2011, before and even maybe 6-9 months after the peak. Let's look at where we are now. Prices have come down dramatically, as we all know. They're near their recent highs, just off. There is little buying. There is buying, but there's little buying compared to clients selling back to us. In fact, many of the dealers have been net buyers, buying back from our clients, which is the exact opposite of what we were seeing in 2011. Premiums have collapsed, especially on numismatic gold and 90% silver. Dealers are awash in inventory, and in fact, selling off what we're buying back from clients to refiners in Switzerland. And I promise you, the phones are not ringing, and no one even wants to talk about gold. So that's where we are now. And as you can see, it's the mirror image. It's the mirror opposite of where we were in 2011. And in fact, that I think what we need to do here is, as you said, to look at gold as in a global sense, because what I'm talking about and all that I've just described to you is the U.S. market and primarily the ounce market. And so what really matters with this global currency is the wholesale market, the tonnage market. So let's look at what they were doing at the same time in 2011 and again today. In 2011, as the price of gold rose 1,700, 1,800, 1,900, the wholesale aggregated bid levels were way below where the speculators in the paper gold pushed the price. And they were patient and waited for the price to come to them. Now, what we're seeing since the lows of December 2015, we're watching the wholesale market just gradually, it's slow, but they're gradually stair-stepping higher their bids. Why? Because they need to get a fill. So they're stair-stepping higher their bids. Right now, currently, as of yesterday, today, we're inside the bid level of the wholesale global market. And that market matters because, again, that is the tonnage market.
Explain for our listeners, who are these people that make up this wholesale market you're referring to?
I'm talking about primarily the central bank sovereign wealth funds, the large funds, ones that buy or have a need to buy in extremely large quantities, in essentially in tonnage. That's who they are. I mean, my clients don't buy in tons, right? I don't buy in tons. We buy in ounces. But I think for perspective, because we're insulated from what's going on in the global market causing these very large buyers to increase their buys, that I think it's really important for us to have that perspective because, after all, you know, in London, for instance, I can tell you that the dealers are there are having the opposite experience that we're having. They're selling lots of gold. They're hardly keeping it in. Why? They're subject to Brexit geopolitical risk. Same thing with the German dealers. Why? Because the turmoil in the Middle East is spilling over into Europe, and they're hedging their risk. And so I think it's important for us to understand that that market is a market that we should pay close attention to and that we should understand the dynamics of, because it's the market that is going to propel us forward in the next phase of the secular bull market going higher. And I can promise you, for all of us here, Jim, you know that markets turn up when no one cares, when everyone is disinterested, when we've disgorged as much of the gold and silver as we can disgorge. That's when they turn up. That's where we are now. So that's what the point I'm trying to get across, is that the global market is leading. It's just very difficult for us who are insulated from a lot of that on a day-to-day basis to see it. But that's where we are now.
And when you say they're gradually stair-stepping their bids, at what price are they bidding now? In other words, on the day you and I are speaking, gold's at around 12. Last week it closed at 12.48. Today it's 12.31. At what price? It's down $17. At what price are you seeing these bids start to step up?
Well, right now they have stepped up to 1230 to 1240 to 60. So we're well inside that range. And so exponentially more tonnage of gold is being sought for. And you can see that in Dubai. You can see that at the SGE in Shanghai. So that's where they are. But where have they stepped up from 1050, where we saw the lows in December? They've stepped up from there just gradually. It's a very patient market. They've stepped up from there in increments, I would say, in increments of $30, $40, wherever they feel like they can get a fill. So that's where we are now, which tells me that the carnage that we're seeing now is nearing its end. There's no way to know when it'll end, but I think that we're nearing its end, and I think we'll see another stair step higher in the next several months.
Now, what can you tell us about supply? Because, you know, I just, following the industry, you saw a lot of major companies. I don't care if it was from Newmont to, somebody like Barrick Gold. You've got an issue now with Freeport. The government in Indonesia wants to confiscate its largest producing mine, which produces not only copper, but also gold. What is happening on the supply front from, let's say, the producers?
From what I can understand, that what we have seen is that the producers are more and more headwinds, I would say. And that always happens, you know, Jim, when the price falls, because what matters for them is what they can get it out of the ground for, what price per ounce they can get it out of the ground for. Where are they profitable? Where do they step on the accelerator or not? I can tell you over the last 3 or 4 years that when the price has been low, that it hasn't been in their best interest to go out there with a lot of new projects to mine gold, right? It just makes sense. So what they were doing was mining the gold that was profitable for them and selling that because of the premium. And so, you know, that tells me that supply has slowly, slowly been declining. And as you said, there are other headwinds for miners that include political headwinds, that include, all, you know, operational headwinds, that sort of thing. So while the supply has been declining, then I think that's what basically has been happening there. Now we're just seeing the fallout from some of the things, like you said, with Freeport. We've had some large dealers that supplied a lot of supply to the market that are having trouble because the business is one that we exist on very thin margins and it's high risk. So you could very well see dealers going out of business. So I think the supply has definitely been declining.
And what about the role of Wall Street in dealing with bullion? I know that a lot of Wall Street firms have shed their commodity business. What effect has that had on the business?
I don't really know the ins and outs, honestly, of all of the broker-dealers that have offered gold and silver to their clients. But I can tell you this, that over when we were in the bull market and just afterwards, I heard all the time about them and the prices were being compared, namely, of course, the premiums were being compared to where we can sell, buy and sell them. And I can promise you that the last 2 or 3 years, I've heard little to nothing about what they have been doing in the market, which tells me that it's very likely that they're not active. That's what it tells me.
So in terms of you deal both at the institutional level with hedge funds and you also deal with retailers, what are you seeing now, given the fact if gold bottomed in December of 2015, what are you seeing? What are your clients telling you? What are they doing?
Since November of this year, of last year, what we've seen is an exhaustion effect, essentially, with clients. That because this bear market was longer than anybody could have thought that it would be. It was certainly longer than I have thought it was going to be. And I think we're seeing this exhaustion, Jim. I think people are saying, when is it going to turn? When are we going to resume the secular bull market? And there's also some thought that we might not get there because we might not resume the bull market because of mainstream media reports that many of them, I can tell you, have been not exactly accurate. And I also wonder if they have any insight into the wholesale market, which has been very robust. So for our clients, what's been happening, all of us that buy in ounces, is that a lot have essentially given up on it. We've seen a lot of buybacks where we buy back from our clients, people disgorging. We've seen a lot of people, lots and lots of phone calls of discouragement. And it all surrounds the price action of what's going on. Because if we look at the reasons to own gold, which for everyone it's different, but it's a matter of hedging risk, in my opinion, the risk, you know, of the central bankers. I mean, do we really think that the Fed has it all right? Do we really think that it's all going to be okay? I mean, there's a potential risk there. There are political risks. There are geopolitical risks. There are portfolio risks. So those particular risks we feel are out there, and I can feel that sense of uneasiness with my clients. So we feel that there's a risk out there, but nothing has really manifested itself. Nothing is big, like subprime was big, and we could virtually see that in 2006, 7, of course, 2008. Right now, the risks are pretty well spread apart. We see them in different areas, but I don't think it's a risk that is so obvious to people, but they know that it's out there, so they're uneasy. But they're also saying, is anything ever going to happen to make me need to have these hedges in place? And to that I say, again, do we really think the political risk, the geopolitical risk, the risk of the Fed policy, portfolio risk, do we really think that risk has diminished or has it increased? And to me, it's all increased. We ebb and wane. I know that after the election, everybody feels like we're back on a growth path, that it all can happen. But the reality of that in an economy our size is just not accurate. And so I think that we have a combination of people who are tired watching the price of gold, not the reasons to own it, and not seeing that the risk and the reasons for owning it are actually increasing, not decreasing. That's what we've been saying.
So let's say that in the wholesale market, it's gradually stair-stepping its way higher as these big institutions, whether it's central banks, sovereign wealth funds, continue to accumulate now as the price comes to them. Basically, if an individual starts, let's talk about the different ways to accumulate either gold or silver. So I know that, for example, on the silver side, Kathy, if I wanted to get the closest to the price of silver, I would probably buy something like a silver round. Then you have things like sovereign coins. So let's take the American Silver Eagle. You have smaller bars. You can get a 10-ounce bar, a 100-ounce bar, or a 1,000-ounce bar if you're buying on the COMEX. And likewise with gold. You can get a small denomination that is non-sovereign, or you can buy things like eagles or maples or sovereign gold coins. Let's talk about the best way for somebody that would like to accumulate and get themselves in the market. And then at the very high end, you have something called numismatics, which are collectible coins. I wonder if you just briefly go through those quickly.
Sure. You know, Jim, as you've said so many times, it's all about getting the most amount of ounces for your money. And you named some of the ways to do that now. I will say, too, that along with getting the most amount of ounces for your money, it's for me as a dealer, it's being sensitive to the type of risk each individual client is trying to hedge. So let's go through. As you mentioned, on the silver side, the silver rounds are really inexpensive. We've sold a lot of Buffalo silver rounds. Those tend to be the ones that people like. They're inexpensive. The premiums are very low compared to the sovereign coins. A lot of people like the silver eagles or the silver maples, and that's fine too, because they have a different risk in mind that they are trying to hedge. And so, but I think that if you just really wanted the lowest, go with the silver rounds. The bars are fine too, absolutely. If you wanted to accumulate more ounces and you didn't mind having one that was a tiny bit less liquid, I would use the 100-ounce bars. Whether they're JM's, Engelhard's, Royal Canadian Mint, it doesn't matter. So those premiums are low too. And then you get into the sovereign coins. On the gold side, the smallest denomination coins, the fractional coins, are generally the most expensive, and that's because they are the ones that are hardest to fabricate. And I'm talking about the half ounce, the quarter ounce, the 10th ounce, and in some cases, the 20th ounce. So I'd stay away from those because they're going to be very expensive. But certainly you can buy 1 ounce bars. Those are absolutely fine. The bigger bars, if you want to store more wealth in there, those are fine. Gold Eagles are fine. Gold Maple Leafs are fine. I think those are all okay. Now, let me address the numismatic situation. I want to take out the current situation with numismatics because it is very unusual. Let's say prior to the beginning of this year, when we, in a normalized market, we're not at extremes, and I feel like we are at just a tiny extreme right now on the downside. And so when you're not at that extreme, generally, the numismatic market for both gold and silver carries very high premiums. You know, I remember 3 or 4 years ago, some of the silver numismatics were carrying premiums when we were at $14, $15 silver. You could only have them for $24, $25. That is not the time to buy them. It's all about the premiums you're paying relative to the premiums on the bullion. So, and that's also the way with gold, whether it's 20 Libs or St. Gaudens or some other type of numis. Now, what has happened very recently in the last several months is that the premiums on the numismatic, and I'm talking about low-grade slabs like MS62 Saints, or, and also maybe some of the raw ones, the AUs or so, and also the 90% silver, those have declined so substantially that the premiums versus a bullion product were very attractive. So in that case, which is a very specialized case. And this is, they're not historic low premiums because that obviously happened pre-1933. But for the last decade or so, these are very low premiums. And so when they're low relative to the premiums of the bullion market, then I think they are good buys because those premiums can expand on the upside. But that is a very, very specialized event. It doesn't happen often, and it usually doesn't last long. So for those that want to buy, or if you're new to the market and you're being told to buy a numismatic coin, and we're obviously talking about pre-1933 in gold and 65 in silver, then the question I would ask is, what is the premiums of the bullion so that you can compare the two and, again, get the most ounces for your money? That's really what it comes down to in all markets.
Yeah, that's always been our message, Kathy, here on the program. If you're accumulating bullion as a hedge, really what you want to do is accumulate as many ounces as you can and pay the least amount for those ounces should determine the type of investments that you make in bullion. Kathy, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work or find out more about what you do as a dealer, how could they do so, please?
The best way is to call. I really love to talk to people and to help them understand where we are in the global markets and try to figure out what it is they're trying to do, what it is they're trying to hedge, and what is best for them. So the best way to reach me, my direct line is 214-750-7300 or our toll-free 877-718-8777. They can email me at kathy@kdpm.com. And, of course, there's always our website, which is kdpm.com.
Well, listen, Kathy, thanks for coming on the program and updating us on the market. Rather interesting to get the different perspective of what's going on in the wholesale market versus what is going on in the retail market. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Jim. Always a pleasure.
You know, one of the things history shows us is that most major market tops actually come to an end right after stocks are selling at high and extreme prices compared to their real world valuation. This is the second highest priced stock market in history. And one of the indicators is that every recession and bear market seems to be preceded by Federal Reserve rate hikes. So here's the question. If we are in a bubble today, remember, think back to the tech and internet stocks of the 1990s and the real estate bubble in the 2000s. Where is the bubble? That's the funny part. People don't seem to notice where things are overvalued and going very rapidly with no consideration of the real world valuation of the stock. So that's the question. Inside the bubble, what's it going to look like? And then what's going to cause the blow off? Speaking of blow offs, we're facing a coming age of volatility in oil. It seems like most of the financial channels still keep watching what's going on in terms of inventories, but that is not the bigger picture right now with U.S. shale in the picture and OPEC then on the other side. We could be entering a new age of volatility, which would look much more like a free-for-all rather than the stability that we have seen over decades. And that means something for people investing in oil producing companies because of the tremendous amount of investment required and the tremendous risk in drilling for oil and generating it from various parts of the world. So all of that we will be examining coming up next on The Big Picture, especially the investment implications as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.